Hello and welcome to The Week at Work. I'm your host this week, Dave Gibney. I'm joined by my co-host, Michelle Byrne, and also by our special guest this week, Stefan O'Nuolan from Trademark Belfast, where we're going to get some insights. And actually, do you know what? We'll go straight to Stefan about this and I'll do the plug for the podcast later, or for the Patreon later. Stefan, big news breaking this week up north. Do you want to tell us a little bit about what's happened? Obviously, we have to bear in mind all the restrictions are around conversations around the allegations that are all popping around on WhatsApp groups and in on social media, and the allegation, all that side of it. But just specifically getting into the politics of it, what's happening up north now?
Well, everyone knows the story, I suppose. The question for us is, what's the political implications of Donaldson's arrest, I suppose, and the court cases to follow? And what damage it'll do to the DUP and what damage it does to unionism, I suppose, are the bigger questions, you know. But I suppose in the short term, there's going to be a battle within the DUP, the battle we thought that he'd won, if you like, in terms of, believe it or not, Donaldson represents the progressive side of the DUP. I know that's hard to imagine, but because of his departure, and there's going to be another potentially internal battle now between the left, not the left, I suppose, but the more reactionary side of that party, represented by, you know, Sammy Sausage Fingers and people like that, who will come back with a vengeance and try and kind of win the party back, worried as they are about, you know, their kind of right flank, the TUV, stealing votes off them. But even if they do come back and win and they install someone as the new leader, as opposed to Gavin Robinson, who stepped in for the moment, it kind of just speeds up really the something that was already happening, which was a terminal decline of that kind of unionism, you know, that kind of blood and soil evangelical unionism. It's kind of, this day is done, really, you know, and it's kind of in a shrinking state. It's like they leave one dark room and they enter another dark room that's slightly smaller than the dark room they've just left, and then they don't, and that's their direction of travel, really. What it means politically is Eastwood, the Alliance woman, she'll probably win his seat in Lagan Valley. Which gives the Alliance, I imagine, at the next election, that gives her a real good shot at taking his Westminster seat. And that will change things, because that means then that there's like seven unionists, two Alliance and nine nationalist seats in the British Parliament, which is 9 and 9. And a lot of people are saying that's the position where the British Secretary of State could call a border poll. So that's the big implication.
Well, that's the implication if a by-election is called, but the elections have to take place by January anyway. So, you know, I was reading through the Irish news earlier on, and they were saying they don't expect a by-election to be called. They'll just leave the seat vacant until the elections are called. So it may not have that implication, but there's...
But even if it's like a November general election, British general election, it probably means that the DUP will lose that seat. It was quite close in the foot, and they could also lose another couple of MLAs from that constituency as well. So it just means, it just indicates the continual decline of that brand of unionism, I think. You know, I don't think it's... Not that it's going to disappear anytime soon, it'll be around. It still represents the views of, you know, a couple of 100,000 voters in the north. But I think it just signals the ongoing shift within unionism from like blood and soil unionism to a more like civic unionism represented by the UUP and the Alliance Party. All of that plays into Sinn Féin's hands, of course, and into their project, I suppose, you know.
Does it? Will Sinn Féin actually be the beneficiaries of this? Because SDLP. Well,
in the bigger picture, yeah. If what is the bigger picture? The bigger picture is border poll. I mean, that's all of the political pressure now. Is when's that border poll going to be called? Is it in the next? You know, will it be in the next parliament? That's really the big political play here. Because once a border poll is called, even if it's a no vote, it probably would be a no vote. It means there's one every 7 years after that. So there will be another border poll after. So the sooner they call this one, the sooner they get the second, and that 7 year period would be the crucial bit. Because there's more, depending on what happens in that 7 year period, there's more likely a chance of a yes vote for unification. So that's the big project here. Like, that's what the Shinners are aiming at, I suppose. You know, and if they win or get into government in your little free state, that will be their primary political goal, won't it? To put pressure on the British state to call a border poll. That'll be everything for them.
Yeah, see, that's the problem they have, is that the border poll can't be called true democracy or democratic means as such, because that the whim isn't of the Secretary of State, or who?
Yeah, it is. It's one of the major flaws in the good. There are plenty, like, but it's one of the major flaws in the Good Friday Agreement, that there was no, you know, there's no political route to call a border poll. It's, as you said, so the whim of the British state. And as we know, Starmer's going to win the next election by a landslide, by the look of it. He's quite a unionist, so he might not be under any pressure to call it at all.
Yeah, that's interesting. Michelle, I don't know if you have any observations of what's been happening on the Jeffrey Donaldson front.
Yeah, I guess my main one was actually probably what you were reading as well, Dave, and some of the Southern news around, the interim leader Gavin Robinson saying that, he's offering assurances that we know it's not the party isn't in trouble, but also making sure to say that the DUP shouldn't be distracted by a leadership contest this side of the general election, which I thought was interesting, just drawing comparisons to exactly what's happened in the South at the moment, where obviously Leo Varadkar stepped down and Simon Harris just assumed that position without an election because everyone who might have been interested kind of stepped away or asked to step away. I don't know what was going on there, but like again, no kind of democratic say, but like again, two parties that like it still has their ideology is rooted in the wrong place anyway, whether whoever's leading it either way. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens from this. But obviously, just to kind of obviously note, like it's a very sensitive case, and there's a lot of people have been talking about this quite a lot since it's been released. And while we can have the analysis on the political side of things, there is someone behind all of this who is dealing with a huge public piece around this, so just to kind of keep that in mind as well.
I think the
Yeah,
big
of
thing
course.
about the Gavin Robinson thing and the leadership thing is that if there's a leadership, the biggest fear really, if there's a leadership challenge, is the instability that will bring to the assembly. And the fact that if it was won by the right of the party, by Sammy and Poots and that kind of right wing of the party or extreme right wing of the party, they would do everything in their power to bring down the assembly, I imagine. I mean, they're not happy with it. So that's the danger of that leadership election that Michelle was referring to, because it would reintroduce instability, and no one, apart from a few hardcore DUPs, no one wants the assembly to fall again, in
If
places
it
like the
does
Southern.
fall, could an election be called then? Yeah, I presume it would.
Well, it could, but the Brits wouldn't do that. They'll just play it out again, and it would become another fucking, 6 months or a year. I mean, that it will fall anyway at some point, the assembly. I mean, if it's not this crisis, it will be another crisis in 18 months or 2 years, and it will be down again for another 2 years, and then it'll be up again, because the permanent. It's permanently unstable, this place. I mean, it's not, I'll just keep reminding people, it's not survivable as an entity. It's not politically, culturally, economically doable, this place. So
Yeah, and
eventually it will go to a border poll and reunification at some point in the dim and distant future.
yeah, and interesting enough, like given the weekend that it is, there's a lot of commemorations going on for the Easter Rising. But there is a piece in the Independent this weekend, qu quoting Bertie Ahern, on the Jeffrey case actually, at the commemoration. So he's saying like, oh, I've known Jeffrey for 35 years, and I couldn't believe it. But he kind of notes in his couple of comments, that he thinks that the concerns are stability of the institutions, that everything will stay settled, and that all the parties in the executive want to see business continue as it was. And that like line of business continue as it was really stuck with me. I know obviously it's only recent enough that an executive been formed, but as you say, Stevie, it's hardly been plain sailing, and like it's not going to be plain sailing either, like because business as usual isn't good enough. What's happening up there isn't actually serving the working class. So just thought it was interesting that he used that line. And then I just like in the same mouth, like he's talking about Bertie Ahern or whatever they're trying to do. I was trying to revive him for a presidential candidate or something, whatever. But he talks about, oh, the proclamation says, to pursue happiness and prosperity of the whole nation and all its parts, cherishing all the children and nation equally. But like, even in the South alone, he's obviously talking to a lot of people in the South in his comments, but this week alone, the government has broken another homeless record. So now we're at 13,841 people who are homeless. And that doesn't include people who are rough sleeping or couch surfing or other forms of hidden homeless. But what it does do, it includes 4,170 people, children. So like, he's like saying, oh, well, we should stick to this and all of that. But like, I don't know, like this whole revival of Bertie again, I thought they'd done a stint of it a couple of months ago, but he's back again, it seems.
Are they getting him ready for the presidency? Is he
I'd say
the
so.
name? Is he the name they're floating? Is it for the next to replace
I think
Nickleby?
he's the name he's floating. And I think the outside of the party itself, because I could be wrong on this, but I haven't seen anyone within the party calling for Bertie to run within Fianna Fáil, like because I think they do know he's a bit toxic, but the media seem to still be, every now and then Especially when there's Republican activity on something, Bertie's rolled out because he's seen as a counterbalance to any progress that Sinn Féin can get. Oh, Bertie is the man who solved all the troubles in the North. He brought about the Good Friday Agreement and all that sort of
Does a
stuff. But
president does a president of Ireland need a bank account, or is he okay just to deal in cash? Is that okay for the president just to deal in cash?
can you imagine getting the Oris plastered by Paddy the Plasterer? I mean, there'd be a lot of envelopes flowing around in there. But on a serious note, like, it is a big worry of mine that they will run them, because there is an element within Irish society that still thinks Q-tourism is okay. It's sound, it's grand, right? And a large part of them are actually working in the media, because there's articles today, and you're just looking at it and going, oh, here was it Michael McDowell's one, and that he could be the savior of Irish democracy. I think it's in the Business Post. I'm just like, this guy couldn't even get elected in his own constituency the last time he ran. And then because he didn't get in, he didn't even stick to his political party. He just abandoned it. That's the type of selfish individualism that is being promoted out there. And yet, they revert back to Mr. Bertie as if he was the bringer of good times. They forget about the financial crash. And the only journalist who really held his feet to the fire, well, there was two of them. Vincent Brown asked him questions and he was just batted away. And the other one was a German lad that we all remembered a little clip on the media where he was asking him questions and Bertie just took off his mic and walked out. We're not going to get that level of scrutiny if Bertie runs for the presidential position. Or, and it did cross my mind, but I looked up the candidates and there's already got a number of Fianna Fáil running in the constituency. I was thinking an MEP seat. I was thinking, God, is he going to come back for something there? But no,
But
I don't think
the
it's the
reappearance,
MEP
but
seat.
the reappearance of McDowell is quite funny, isn't it? Because he's come out of nowhere just the last couple of months, I've noticed. And there's been a couple of articles talking about the need for a new right-wing party or a party to the right of Fine Gael, or a rejuvenation of Fine Gael as a right party. And I thought that was interesting, that whole debate clearly happening within the establishment. And you heard it with Simon Harris too about, and a few of the big wigs within Fine Gael talking about the need to dump social liberalism, basically was what they were saying without saying it, and get back to some social conservatism or just economic liberalism. The idea that the idea that really what they're going to focus on now is right wing kind of politics in their old style. And that was quite interesting, because that pivot's happened all across Europe. Most conservative parties that kind of went into social liberalism for the last 10 or 15 years, which hijacked, kind of hamstrung the left to some degree because it stole the cloak of the left. They're pivoting back now to kind of low level social conservatism, but with obviously neoliberal economics. And it looks as if that might be Harris's pitch within Fine Gael. He's under pressure to do the same.
But it's our political elites and establishment are misreading the results of that referendum, I believe. I really sincerely believe that they've looked at this. There's been a vote, and given Padraig Tobin all of the kudos for winning a referendum against all of the might of Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, Labour, Soc Dems, everyone else that was going on along with it. It's not that Padraig Tobin won it. It's that people, actually working class people, to a large degree, in most communities, are very, very fucking smart and understood that this was a neoliberal wording for the carers referendum. Varadkar coming out the week beforehand and saying, I don't believe the state should have responsibility for looking after people with disabilities and all the rest of it. Most people are looking at it and going, yes, the state should have some level of responsibility for looking after people with disabilities and helping out carers. So them all going, oh no, this is aimed to, and this is the far right who've won, this is nonsense. It's a misreading of the situation, but that misreading seems to suit them. And we were looking at the article by Justine McCarthy yesterday, in the Irish Times, talking about the sudden stampede to the right by our politicians can only benefit democracy. And I think it was a little bit of a misleading headline by Justine, well, by the headline writer on the article. But again, it's jumping to conclusions around the reasoning for Leo Varadkar's resignation, saying it's related to the collat or the failure to pass the plebiscites, the two referenda. But it's not. Like, he's gone because he's toxic. He's a liability. People don't like him, and Fine Gael have recognised that and pushed him. And that it to me, it's as simple as that. So it's very frustrating to see this misreading of the by people who, by the way, are in the political stream. They know what's going on. So pretending that we've moved dramatically to the right all of a sudden is nonsense. And we're going to see
But if
that
you,
play
but no,
out.
but if you, if you step back from that though and look at Ireland within the context of Europe, that pivot to the right is happening all across Europe. I mean, I know that each country has its own context and its own story to tell, but there is a pivot to the right And it's a pivot to the right, and it doesn't always, it's not always just, you know, a pivot to far right ideology or the far right, but it's a pivot back to kind of core neoliberalism surrounded by deeper state authoritarianism. And why? Because neoliberalism's fucked. I mean, the economy's flatlining. I mean, back in 2012, the United States economy was the same size as the EU economy. The United States economy is twice the size of the EU economy now, 14 years later. And the European economy is absolutely screwed. Now, it's fucked itself because of Ukraine, because of Russia, because of oil, because of LNG, because of all of the things it's done over the last 2 or 3 years, really. But the economy is in real trouble. And I think that's why we're seeing this pivot kind of to the right almost, you know, and you're going to see increasing levels of authoritarian neoliberalism emerging across Europe. You've seen it in Britain, you see it in France, you see it all over the place. Sometimes it manifests itself as, you know, far right parties doing well. But in other places, it's just centrist conservative parties shifting to the right, you know. So I think it's not just about what happens in Ireland. This is a European trend, if you like.
Yeah. Well, the gist of Justine McCarthy's article is that as the mainstream Fine Gael right-wing party moves further to the right, it cuts the legs off the far right, the Nazis, which, you know, you can say that's an argument, but I don't necessarily subscribe to the, yes, this is great, Fine Gael are moving further to the right, because they were already as far on the right as I'd like them to be. But I did, there's an article in the Business Post today, which is a really interesting one. Dominic McGrath, red and blue, can Liverpool turn Tory? Bit of a weird out of the blue piece. I was actually published yesterday, but it's talking about Liverpool hasn't elected a Tory since, I think it was 1988 or something, for any seat, anywhere at all. And now they're talking about, oh, maybe it's time for Liverpool to return to conservatives and Toryism and all that sort of stuff. And again, it's this whole, is this journalists just wishful thinking that they're putting down on paper? And it's like, why would you publish some shite like that in the Sunday Business Post in Ireland about Liverpool talking about, can they turn Tory? It's like, where is this coming from? Mad. It's a crazy article anyway, but it's good to see that.
It's clearly, who's the writer? It's clearly coming out of his or her ass. The idea that fucking Liverpool would turn Tory is just ridiculous. Yeah. I mean, that British election I read yesterday, I know you're not talking about it exactly, but they're talking about the Tories losing so many seats, they're going to drop beneath 100 seats in the British Parliament. So it's going to be a fucking wipeout for them. They're talking about 98 seats in the latest poll.
What are they at now?
Something like over 300 or something. I mean, it's a wipeout for them, you know. It's generated. But then again, they've just been replaced by another Tory party, so it doesn't really matter. And I think Labour's going to be horrendous in government in the next 5 years. But there you go.
But before we wrap up on that then, because you saw Owen Jones's video, I presume, there last week, calling for people to not vote for the Labour Party. What's the perspective? You'd be speaking to a lot more people over in Britain than I would be, and in England in particular. Like, is there
a split on the left? There's a split on the traditional left. The traditional left in Britain says, "Oh, stay in the Labour Party. It's our party. We have a history." But and even the CPB, like British Communists, would be in and around the party and telling everyone to stay in it. But an awful lot have drifted away. An awful lot have left, as usual. More so than usual over this one, because what people see is happening is that you're going to see a form of neoliberalism under Labour that will be organised, that will be state run, that will be state controlled. And the big ticket item in the next 5 years is going to be the privatisation of the NHS. And that's what Wes Streeting and others have promised basically to the American health insurance company. It was like, it's like TTIP. They're like doing TTIP all on their own, New Labour. That's what they're going to, that's what they're planning to do, you know. And the big prize, if you remember the TTIP and discussions from 7 or 8 years ago before it was stopped by Trump, good man, was the jewel in the crown was European health and European health insurance, you know, and that's the one thing that Labour's going to do. They're going to wreck the NHS, or they're going to privatise it increasingly over the next 5 or 6 years. So that's what we've got to look forward to.
Yeah, and I suppose the reason, one of the key reasons that the Labour Party and why Owen Jones has taken the position that he has isn't necessarily that he's moving further to the left or anything politically. It's more a reaction to what's gone on in Gaza, and a lot of people have just said, you know what, my red line is genocide. And when you have the leader of the Labour Party coming out and saying, yeah, Israel has a right to shut off food, water, energy to an under siege people while they're being bombed, and you know, 33,000 people have now been killed, then
can I just ask Michelle a quick question? Can I know Michelle's in the same union as me, but you'd be closer to a lot of the people over in Britain in Unite. Michelle, what's the debate over there regarding Labour? Are people leaving? Are people still throwing it their support? I know the leadership of Unite have been very kind of cagey about it, but
Unite, I guess, like Sharon Graham, the general secretary there, does release statements saying, you know, that Labour needs to step up, and that, you know, that quite regularly she would say that the conversations with him are difficult. They have, as part of their agreement for funding, have regular meetings, and she's been quite open about how difficult it is to have those conversations, and that the funding is conditional, and that it's not always guaranteed, and if this doesn't change, obviously, that's at risk. You know, ordinary rank and file members in Unite who are also in Labour, like, there's still some of the structures within Unite in Britain are very interlinked. Like, there's Labour Unite committees and all of that, so it's quite interlinked. Quite surprisingly, actually, when I started getting involved with some of the cross with the stuff in Britain as well, to see how interlinked it was. So it is kind of starting to, you know, people are starting to, like, understand the politics of the Labour Party and how difficult it is to be, you know, to be a trade unionist while you have, for example, like, Labour Party councillors voting against workers in their council positions and them having to be. But you do see the likes of then Sharon Graham then actually, you know, removing their membership, kicking them out of the membership of Unite. So that's good to see. So maybe that's kind of heightened people's understanding of what's actually happening in that. But I do see some young members still running for council positions who are members of Unite, who are running for Labour, but there definitely is a bit more of an understanding there, I think, about how it doesn't go. And I definitely made a point as well when the vote was coming up again for Britain to be reaffiliating themselves with Labour, and I was like, look, learn from our mistakes. Don't do this. Like, you know, you can say, oh, we'll hope out for one more term of funding. And then, you know, then maybe we'll have our say when they're in government. And, you know, the idea of, like, we'll be closer to them when they're in government, so we'll have more of a say and more power. But, you know, look what happened to the Labour Party here in Ireland when they got to government, and, you know, we can draw direct links as well.
It always amazes me, Michelle. It always amazes me how many young socialists and even communists who I know in Britain who are in the Labour Party, who join the Labour Party, and, like, if they read one book about the history of the Labour Party, they would know it's fucking history. They would know it's an imperialist party. They would know it's actually a Zionist party, and always has been, by the way, right back to the 1920s. You know, this isn't Starmer's position on Israel isn't a new thing. It's been in the DNA of that party for 80, 90 years, you know what I mean? And it just amazes me how people misread that party. Particularly, I mean, the Corbyn was an accident, and everyone knows it was an accident. It was a sudden surge of leftism, but it was it's gone now, and it'll never be back, that party, you know what I mean? So they need to look somewhere else if they can look for the kind of transformers of political change we all want to see happening, you know? Because the Labour Party fucking isn't it.
Well, that's what was so disappointing, I suppose, about the McLynch call, that, you know, it's still so staunchly within the Labour Party and pushing for that among a union like the RMT, which is quite militant and has that anti-imperialist sort of background, because of, you know, the members that they've had over the years. But to see McLynch pushing again for people to join a party which had already made the call I mentioned earlier on, which is Israel has the right to stop food, water, and energy entering into Gaza while Gaza is being attacked and bombed from every angle. I'm trying not to curse here, but yeah, for anybody to still be promoting that, I mean, what is your line? Where is your red line here? Do you know, like, is genocide not the red line in any political party or any society? You know, it's mental that people are still going, you know, vote for Starmer, and then. The other aspect of Starmer after he made that is the denial, the lies of, I never said that. It's like, we have a video of you saying that. Like, don't just say, look, I lied, or I made a mistake or whatever. It's just very frustrating to see some of that stuff happening.
You do want to see the Tories get hammered just for the sake of it, because it's fun to watch, yeah. You know, from the outside perspective. But it'd be nice if the Tories got hammered and that loads of that Labour top team also lose their seats to independents. That'd be really interesting. Like, that's always streeting. And even Andrew Feinstein is standing against Starmer in his constituency in North London. Andrew Feinstein, if you don't know him, is a former South African parliamentarian now, lives in North London. He's really good. He's brilliant on Palestine and stuff. But he's standing against him. And there is a chance that a couple of the top team in Labour will lose their seats to independents. And that would be great. Jarden Foyder.
It's just then about, what does a government look like?
Who gives a shit? What? This doesn't matter. I mean, blue Tories, yeah. Red Tories. It's gonna. That's all you're gonna get. You know, it's two cheeks in the same arse. You know, it's the American model, isn't it?
Yeah. That's the first past the post system. But then you have, and Michelle, you might want to talk about this bit. But Israel has sent us a very stern warning to Ireland over calls to break trade links. I presume you read that article as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Like thinly veiled threat by the Israeli embassy. You know that if we were to break trade links, that there would be reciprocal measures. And that we failed to consider this. Failed to consider this. It's not like we're organizing a campaign exactly to do this, like to cut ties. It's not that we failed to consider it. We've considered it and have decided that it's a good strategy. Such good strategy that it warrants Israeli embassy to come out and say, "Don't do that. Please don't do that." So, you know, that's telling you something that, you know, it's not to say they're threatening us at a good time, but like, you know, that's exactly what we're hoping to do, to cut all ties. And like we've seen the figures only, was it last week or the week before, where we spoke about the numbers of the kind of the exports that we're exporting to Israel. Like that could be dual use exports. Very, very concerning. Yeah, so I think that absolutely the fact that the Israeli embassy have had to come out and say this means that we're on the right track. I feel like in the last number of weeks anyway, that the BDS actions have escalated. You know, we've seen a lot of people going into stores and taking products off shelves. That's obviously impacting them. We've seen even just yesterday, we've seen activists actually go onto the US military base in Shannon Airport and go in to the airport there, and just as far as I can see, they strolled onto the actual runway and had a slew of Garda vans and everything come at them, and they were arrested on the spot. But I think, and they're being called the Shannon Three activists, but I think it's really interesting as well, because you know the day they did that was it was the day that was the Palestinian Land Day has been marked. You know, and I think one of the people who was arrested is, like I was reading about it, two of them are Galway, Ireland Palestinian Solidarity activists on that committee, but the other person is actually an artist, Emer Walsh. And I'd be familiar with some of their work, because they actually, some of their previous work has been around the theme of land. So they actually did this really interesting piece of this booklet. I have it here, The Land for the People, The Sexual Case for Land Reform in Ireland. It's a workbook, but it's all kind of like exploring the case for like decolonization of the land and the impact of the British state on the land in Ireland, and the fact that they're involved in this action on Land Day to highlight the intersectionality of the struggles of Ireland and Palestine, I think is actually quite remarkable. It's actually really interesting to see that happen. But they also flagged that, like, yes, while there was three activists arrested yesterday, and that they're like younger activists in their 20s and 30s, that actually this is just them continuing on the struggle. There's been monthly protests outside Shannon Airport by anti-war activists for a long, long time. Again, calling for sanctions, calling for the imposition of arms embargo on Israel is what the action was for yesterday. But again, not allowing weapons for airspace and to end all military use. And like this does bring it to the attention, obviously, again. And I know on the 14th of April, the monthly protest that Shannon Watch and the anti-war activists organized down there is going to be on. So I'd encourage people to go down the 14th of April. It's a Sunday and it's a monthly protest. So it's good to see kind of actions heightening there. I've seen a couple of other activists have a presence in Shannon Airport the last 2 weeks as well. So obviously, this is kind of a flashpoint there, where, you know, where people are drawing. That's where we need to go next. You know, we are obviously doing BDS actions in shops and outside companies that are complicit, such as AXA, for example, blocking their. It was actually really interesting. So I've been involved in a couple of the actions outside AXA in Waterford. And each time they've done it, and we've done it different times and different days, they've put up a sign saying, "We're on training, and we'll pull up banners. Well, you can't see anything inside. You can hear a rustle of someone behind the pull-up banners." And then you walk away and you find out they've took down the training sign like 2 minutes later. But when there was a national day during the week, where a number of different places at the same time, all of them put the same sign up: "We're all on training at this time in AXA." And you know, you'd have to ask, is the training on how to support the Zionist project potentially? But you know, it's interesting to see that impact there. But also interesting to see, you know, because I think it ties into some of the stuff that we're seeing from, you know, trade unionists against genocide. The trade union Left Forum put up a post during the week. Dave, maybe you want to talk a bit more about it, but like how people who work in places that are impacted, you know, that there are people are calling for boycotts for. And we have spoken about it here already. But I think like I reposted that actually during the week on my Instagram, and Instagram has already censored it. It was sensitive content, discouraging it to share. Like, no, you shouldn't get ideas to share with workers and how they can use their worker power to also engage in leveraging the BDS asks. But I thought it was very, very interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting. Well,
can I ask a quick question? Yeah, sorry, because I was following that. What about the Irish government's intervention in the ICJ in the South Africa case? What's provoked that, and what's that? How significant is that, or is it at all?
Don't think it's very significant. Yeah, don't think it's very significant at all. You know, that just allows them to put in a comment. It actually doesn't say what they're going to do. They're just going to. That just allows them to add their name in and respond to it. But actually, like some of the commentary coming from the government actually doesn't really draw a lot of confidence that it's going to be strong in any way.
Well, Francesca Albanese, the UN Special Rapporteur on occupied Palestinian territory, said yesterday that Ireland, the countries that have been the most outspoken, like Ireland, what have they done in practice? Nothing. Zero. This is coming from an expert over there saying that there's lots of strong talk, but they're actually doing nothing whatsoever. So saying they're going to intervene, we don't know what that intervention is going to be. It would be useful if they added their name on a positive side to back South Africa, but there's no even confirmation that that's what's going to happen. But like,
it's a PR exercise.
Yeah, and there is an election and a European election coming up, and they do, you know, Fine Gael in particular, do need to show some sort of solidarity on this, because the surveys last week that we covered, I think it was 67% of people supported a boycott of Israeli goods. Like, they know the vast majority of Irish people are supportive of this issue of the Palestinian people. So there's a little bit of that, you know, they don't want Sinn Féin in particular getting a lead, or People Before Profit or whoever, because it is going to be a tight election in Dublin for a European seat. And I really think Fine Gael are under pressure, because Regina Doherty is just not likable. So there's this element of, you know, people are saying Claire Daly's going to get elected. There's going to be at least one Sinn Féin person, probably Liam Boylan is the rumour, but Dáithí Doolan is there as well. And there's a chance that they may end up getting two, however unlikely that might seem. So there's one seat left then, because there's only four seats left. So who's that? Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael? Now, I don't suspect that Sinn Féin will get two. So there will be two seats left. But I don't think there's a seat for both Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael in an easy way, because of the candidates they're up against. And look, we're going to do a couple of special shows around some of this stuff. But the reality is, like, if the Irish government wanted to, they could demand the collapse of the European Alliance Trade Agreement and the Horizon Project with Israel. They could say, and they can cite it, it's on in some of the documents that we've put out over in the past, Article 2 of that agreement actually explicitly states if any side is breaching human rights, the entire deal should be scrapped. And if you're under investigation for fucking genocide in the ICJ and they say it's plausible, I think that's a breach of human rights. So if Ireland wanted that, they can go into the European Parliament and demand that trade agreement is gone. So, but just in relation to the call for workers, like, I was contacted after that post went out, Michelle, on Instagram by a number of old friends of mine who are not in the trade union movement, not lefties, not, you know, political at all. I'm not going to get into the very deep specifics of it, but one works for an airline, a cargo company that deals with stock coming in. Like, these are the people who are bringing in stock from Tel Aviv. And this particular person said to me that she's prepared to stand on her own on this and be sacked. So there is a huge appetite. I'm contacted by a couple of people in Galway as well. But there's a huge appetite for workers to be able to take this type of action, because their government is not facilitating it. So what it means is, and we discussed it very quickly last week, but, you know, in order to get to this point, you know, have a look at the trade union left forum. There's a little bit of an explainer on their website and on their social media pages. You need to make a demand that your contract of employment is changed. And if your contract of employment isn't changed, then you can get into a trade dispute and refuse to handle goods. And if they victimize you for that, then there's a chance that you'll be able to defend your case. So other than that on Israel, I don't know if there's anything else, Michelle, you wanted to talk about there.
Yeah, well, I read a headline on that Israel may cut off Palestinian banks from the global banking system next week, actually. And I just thought, like, the fact that the Israeli finance minister can actually suggest that he can do that and that can do that, you know, he has that power over Palestinian banks and the economy there, just kind of says a lot about how Palestinians are able to live at the moment. And obviously we've covered here like difficulties that people have been having even trying to get money over as it is, and using the Palestinian banking system to transfer money, like through AIB has been blocked, and a number of other entities have been blocking, you know, certain fundraising elements have been blocked because of being able to transfer funds to actual Palestinian banks. Like, yes, the international NGOs have been able to take money, but actual Palestinian banks. But this is even more concerning, that, you know, there is a further escalation here. And, you know, we talked about the control they have over water, land, all of that already. But this is another step of escalation, I think, and obviously in such grave circumstances of this man-made Israeli state-made genocide and famine that's happening. So it's very, very concerning that they may not have access to their banks, you know, if that's that's being considered as well.
Yeah, but I'm going to move on now to some other issues as well, but I just think it's interesting that this is the week as well that Vincent Boland decides to write an article. If RTE and the BBC are to stay the same, then they have to change. And it's really about, you know, does RTE deserve any public funding? And it's, you know, same with BBC. And he doesn't talk about the differences between them in it, but it's really, no, this, okay, it's a polemic, a little personal opinion piece about why RTE is shite. And look, we could all do that. We could all easily write up and choose the worst parts of RTE, but he doesn't get into the importance of a public funded broadcast and media outlet, particularly at a time when the media, the vast majority of the media that we consume, is owned by billionaires and millionaires, particularly on this island as well. Like, so we need RTE more, not necessarily RTE, but we need public service broadcasting more than ever before, because we're not getting the real stories about some of these major international affairs that's been happening. And we've seen it in the reporting that's gone on about the war in Russia and Ukraine. We've seen it in the Gaza stuff and how people have to correct RTE on some of the things that they've had to do. We really need this level of independence. But the problem we have, even with RTE, the biggest problem we have is that it accepts private advertisement revenue, and that influences editorial decisions. And I don't care what anybody says, that has to go down that road. So what we do need is the eradication of all ads on RTE. I think the one of the lines that stood out for me in this article, the RTE2 listings for Tuesday and Wednesday offer terrible value for money. If Home and Away and DIY SOS are the best that can do, RTE is doomed. Like, we could pick out the worst things we could possibly want to see in RTE and use them as leverage to scrap RTE or to scrap the funding of RTE. But let's be real about it. Like, Primetime investigates, and there's been so many things that have come out as a result of RTE doing deep dives on these things, especially around corruption in Irish society, corruption in our political arena. So why not focus on that stuff instead of reruns of fillers like Home and Away? But it, clearly we're in a race now, even within the media, a race to the bottom in Ireland. And it's a very dangerous game to be playing. I don't know, have you got anything else there you wanted to touch on?
Yeah, well, actually, I can tie it into what you were just saying about the media, but it's actually kind of reverting back to the stuff on Palestine as well, like, because I don't think this stuff is covered in the media. But like earlier in the week, there was two Palestine solidarity activists that were... both women who were strip searched in two separate incidences. One was off the back of a BDS action where she was putting stickers on products, and they were strip searched, arrest and strip searched off the back of that. And another case, Lena Seal, who's been an activist around a lot of the Palestine stuff, but also in supporting people in the international protection applicants around Mount Street as well. I've seen her working in. But, you know, she was detained for 10 hours, strip searched for putting water-soluble paint on the Department of Foreign Affairs. So, like, there's this trend now of using strip searching, I think, for, like, a sexualized intimidation tactic, like, really designed to, like, intimidate and humiliate people. And interesting enough, like, around our policing laws or, like, kind of transparency around strip searching, like, there's no real guidance around... you know, coming from a policing perspective, there's no real guidance around when and when you can't be strip searched. Can you like, how do you refuse to have that happen? It's not really the case. But it's more about, like, when is it used? Like, where, like, what, like, for what reason did they strip search someone putting a sticker on a product? Or for what reason for putting water soluble paint on a building did you need to be strip searched? So we've seen it a couple of times now, but I think it's becoming more apparent just from speaking to other activists that's been used. Like, I know, for example, someone was strip searched in solidarity for Debenhams protests at the time, but now it seems to be ramping up, and there seems to be, at the moment, we've seen focused on a couple of female activists. But it's just something to be aware of as well. I think it's quite concerning to see that happening. I know, coming down the line, there should be more transparency around places of detention and how they're monitored with the new bill that's coming up down the line. At the moment, like, prisons, for example, are monitored, but places of detention such as the back of a Garda van or a Garda custody or whatever aren't. But I'd like to see things like strip searching and stuff like that really come under the light. And, you know, I think we're going to be quite shocked at how it's used as a tool against activists particularly, very concerningly. So yeah, that's just kind of something I think that wouldn't be covered in the media. Obviously, we would like to see things like that covered more, but you know, we are seeing things being heightening up in that way. And obviously then we've kind of covered here before about the use of special branch now as well to intimidate Palestinian solidarity activists as well. So there's a real heightening of policing around that, but at the same time, the same police force is saying that they can't touch far-right activists for whatever reason, but they're definitely not applying the same for people who are showing, you know, standing up against oppression. So kind of, I think it shows where the kind of the politics of the management of the police force lies, you know. Interesting enough, though, at the same time, you know, there was an article in the Journal, actually, I think it was this morning or yesterday, and it was talking about the policing response at the commemorations in Dublin. And it was talking about, you know, that there's dissident links, and it was real scaremongering, like, you know, to this, obviously it's a commemoration, like, they're marking like the death of revolutionaries who like fought for Ireland. Like, of course it's going to be Republicans of all shades involved. Like, and just thought, like, this whole thing of, like, increased Garda presence in case there's these scary bad guys, and like, what do you think this event is commemorating? Like, what do you actually, like, have we actually whitewashed the event so much now that people don't understand what the thing has been marked for? Like, you have the likes of Bertie Ahern obviously being wheeled out. Like, I don't think does he really support a revolutionary the Easter Rising in the way that it happened? I sincerely doubted. But then you obviously have the likes of you know, Sinn Féin, who like have been marketed for years. You have, like, and from Bertie Ahern to Sinn Féin to people like Anti-Imperialist Action, who were out in Bray as well, like, they're out marking this. I don't think it's really comparable. Sounds very weird to be like, everyone's marking the same event, but does everyone really market it in the same way? Probably not. But I think it goes back to, again, around, you know, what we were saying about what Bertie was saying, the proclamation, like, cherish all the children equally. And while you can't even say that at the moment, like, that's an absolute farce. Like, there is that piece around, you know, that fight was for a socialist republic. And while we definitely don't have socialism, and capitalism is actually subsuming, and we talked about the piece about the republic as well. And but like, a lot of people would see that, like, Bertie Ahern was obviously using it to promote the peace process and that there wouldn't be any more disruption in the Northern Ireland executive. But other people are obviously marking it in a way where we were not actually liberated from, like, well, what the struggle was back then in the first place. You know, we still have imperialism. We still are under the grasp. We're still fighting for decolonization and the socialist republic of the past. But it was interesting because I was in the Business Post yesterday. There was a piece from Ethne Shortall about, you know, Dublin increasingly feel like a failing capitalist experiment. And I was, and like, there wasn't a whole, like, and I was like, wow, the Business Post actually used that headline. I was kind of like, that's unusual. But like, there, like, there's not a lot of like, real political depth in the piece, but it does like frame it in a way that more people are starting to think about it around who was Dublin for. And like, you know, the height of the piece is really like, she's talking about, you know, it's who's the it's private interests reign supreme, you know, hotels and kind of, you know, landlords over, you know, amenities or livability, which is great to see that kind of comparison happening in the Business Post. Like what she's really describing is like the alienation of workers in a capitalist hellscape that I think Dublin is. I've experienced, sorry now, I know there's a lot of people who are here coming from Dublin, but like, you know, I lived in Dublin for 2 years and I was like, right, I'm going back to Waterford now. It's not, like, I just can't. It was, I found it extremely alienating up there even, you know, a few years ago. But obviously as things are heightening, and like, as the writer said, like, it feels like it's a failed capitalist experiment. You know, the city is being sold off to the highest bidder and is losing its value in the process. And like, you know, a lot of young people will kind of relate that to like, oh, how many nightclubs have we lost in the last couple of years and all of that? Because they've been replaced with hotels. And like, a lot of people are, you know, using that comparison. And I think, you know, that kind of shows like how we're losing so much culture and we're losing so much livability of a city. But yeah, and she finishes off the piece with like, you know, Dublin's priority isn't residents, then it's tourists really, is it, or, you know, capitalist interests, but both. But yeah, interesting piece for the Business Post to publish on, you know, such a weekend where people are, you know, remembering the fight for a socialist republic.
Or eating their chocolate eggs.
Or eating chocolate eggs.
Yeah, whichever one's more important. Which brings me to the James Connolly quote, "The Irishman frees himself from slavery when he realises the truth that the capitalist system is the most foreign thing in Ireland," which is going doing the rounds today and wishing people a happy Easter. Very funny that that's your happy Easter quote for the day. I'm as someone who's lived as in, well, not, I've lived abroad in a few different places, but I've lived most of my life in Dublin. Yeah, it is turning into a very frustrating city to be resident in. Like the just free market society that has no planning in relation to infrastructure, and that can be a little bit frustrating. But what I find, just in relation to your the article, there's one in the Examiner as well, Gardaí monitor dissident Republican linked Easter Rising parade in Dublin. So it goes through all the spiel about what the people were wearing, and they had berets on and they were in dark sunglasses and all that. And then the last sentence is the bit that really got me. "The event passed off without significant incident," which is always the case with these things. If you just don't, like, if the guards don't come in, rush them and try and kick the shit out of people, then it always passes off without incidents. There's never going to be an incident because these things are about respecting the people who fought for Irish independence. So why would anyone want to kick off any trouble? But it's made to sound, and we saw this with the water charges campaign as well. There was always this, oh, dissident Republicans were on the water charges march, as if because of that everybody was going to be shot dead in the, like, on the march. But you know, it's sensationalizing some of that stuff. And again, in the Indo today, or the Sindo today, there's an article by Maria Cahill. "The flag draped funerals of violent people only bring shame on the national flag." Now it's specifically about Piers McCauley, but not the entire thing, but it's talking about all of the different funerals of Republicans over the years where they shouldn't have these national flags on them. But given airtime to such silly as if we're going to have any input on what somebody does, you know, or if their family or their friends or their, you know, whatever does when they're dead, whether they're draped in a coffin or not. I mean, do you think they're having these conversations across the water in America or in England or anywhere else about, you know, these certain people shouldn't have the American flag draped over their coffin? It's a nonsense article, but it's aimed at, as always, at the Republican nationalist side of things. So other than that, the only other thing I wanted to talk about, or not necessarily to talk about but to plug, is the two festivals that are coming up. The first one I'm going to talk about is the James Connolly Festival, which is taking place from Thursday, May 9th until Sunday, May 12th. And there's a couple of good events that we've got an exclusive actually on this one. A couple of good events coming up on that one. And that on the Friday night, you know, I'm very interested in this. Well, actually, we start the Thursday, but there's a talk about land and the people, and there's a couple of really intelligent and really articulate speakers on that one, including Sinead Mercier and Paddy Bresnahan. That's Thursday, May 9th, and I don't have a time for it. On Friday, May 10th, Bloodfruit. The screening of Bloodfruit, which is the first time in years, probably 10 years, since Bloodfruit has been screened in Dublin. Bloodfruit is the documentary about the Dunstores anti-apartheid strike It'll be on in Connolly Books, or the new theatre, I think it's called there, in the back. And afterwards, there'll be a Q&A with Mary Manning, who was the original striker who refused to handle South African goods. So it should be a good talk there. There's a walking tour with Conor McCabe, our own Conor McCabe, on Saturday, May 11th at 11 a.m. And there's a whole range of other things. They're going to be launched, I think, officially on Tuesday. So you'll get to see the full agenda there. The other festival, and I love the overlap here. This is typical of the Irish left. Not criticizing, at least we've got options, a bit like capitalism within the left in Ireland. But we've got the Robert Tressel Festival 2024 as well, which takes place on Saturday, 11th of May. And they've got some really top-notch speakers to come and listen to, including the Michael D. Higgins, who's the obviously the President of Ireland. But we've got Claire Daly, Liz Gillis, Owen Reedy from ICTU, Mick Lynch, Chris Smalls from the Amazon Labour Union as well. So they've got good headlines, speakers there. But you can get tickets for that one on trestlefestival.ie as well. So a couple of good events for people to come up to Dublin, or if you're in Dublin, just to drop in and have a listen to some of the talks anyway. So as I said, James Connolly Festival and the Trestle Festival. Other than that, I'm finished. I've got all my news in. This has been The Week at Work. I've been your host, David Gibney. I want to thank Michelle Byrne, my co-host, and also to Stefano Nulon for joining us. Don't forget, if you want to support this podcast or any of our sister podcasts, you can go to leftblock.ie, or you can support us on patreon.com/leftblock. That's Left Block with no K. And other than that, we'll talk to you all next week. Thanks.